and not enough about apprehension?
That's a good question. I mean, we need both is the obvious thing. And but I think there is a danger sometimes that in an effort to kind of share the gospel, we reduce it to something. We reduce it to a little formula that you can say, or a special prayer, or a little pamphlet with using the metaphor of, you know, motorway one-way signs or something, and say, here's the gospel. And there's no, if it were, there's no headroom in it. There's nothing to grow up into. There's no sense of a beckoning mystery. And it can be a bit dull and reductive. And certainly I can remember being quite off put. I mean, I became a Christian, I'm happy to say, in my final year as an undergraduate. But I might have become one in my first term, had it not, because I'd begun to read St. Augustine as a background to English literature. And I was reading the Confessions. And I was so astonished by that passage, late, late have I loved you, beauty always ancient, always new. And this idea that my heart was restless for something more, and that there was a light. And I was reading this, and there was a knock on my door, and it was two members of the Christian Union who'd come with a little pamphlet to convert me. And they said, you know, this is the Christianity. And it was all a very straightforward, you know, you were born in sin, you're going to hell. But if you do and say the following things, you know, and make the special prayer to Jesus, you'll go to heaven. And it showed you lots of one-way motorway signs, and it showed you a gap. And I said, well, and they said, I said, well, tell me what. They said, this is it. This is all you need to know. They didn't even put a Bible in front of me. They put this pamphlet. And I said, it's funny you should talk about this, because I've just been reading St. Augustine. And they said, we don't believe in the saints. You know, so the whole possibility that there might be something was completely taken away. And I thought, oh, well, this is really sad. I thought from Augustine there was something really in this, but there's clearly nothing in it at all from this pamphlet. That's not, you know, so I was actually put off. And the amazing thing is, when they saw me resisting, they said, you know, God is very gracious, but he's giving you this opportunity. But if you reject him, you know, you might not have rejected him if you hadn't heard of him, but now you've heard of him. And if you reject him, you're going to hell forever. And then I don't know where they got this piece of special knowledge, but they said, but God is merciful, and he would give me to the end of the Michaelmas term to turn to him. But if I didn't turn to him by the end of the Michaelmas term, I'd be in hell forever. I mean, if they're right, I'm in deep trouble, because partly as a result of that conversation, it took me another 2 years to come to it. So, yeah, that was a question of overdoing the comprehension. But I can well imagine, you know, some Christians might make mistakes on the other side. But I'm in favor of having a religion that, and a liturgy as well, where you don't understand everything at every moment, but there's something that you can breathe and grow into. I hope that helps.
Yeah. Commented, apprehension nowadays is used to have an element of fear in it. So he hasn't put it as a question, he's put it as a statement.
That's a very interesting comment. I was using it apropos of comprehend, where the prehend part of that in its Latin roots is to do with taking hold of something. So, you know, I remember learning in zoology about monkeys that had a prehensile tail, which meant they could pick up a cup of tea or whatever, you know, or a nut. And I said it was a very useful thing to have. So apprehend, you can reach out and just get a little bit of it. Comprehend, you can get your whole mind around it. And that's the primary sense in which I was using the word apprehend. However, It is true that the adjective apprehensive, to be apprehensive, does carry an element of fear. And of course, the fear that it carries is the fear of the unknown, precisely because we don't comprehend. Comprehension gives us a sense of safety. But that we must be frank, that on the one hand, there is the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. We come before a mysterium tremendum, you know. We have this sense of the numinous, and we may be a bit apprehensive in that other sense. But on the other hand, the message of the angels is always noli timere, do not be afraid. And Jesus brings the perfect love that casts out fear. But it's no bad thing if there's a little apprehensiveness. I mean, I think there's something a little bit wrong about the very arrogant post-enlightenment Western scientific attitude that goes swaggering around the universe, fearing neither God nor man, and not in the least apprehensive about whether there'll be any bad consequences of all our gross manipulations of atoms and things. You know, I think a little bit of awe and reverence is no bad thing.
Right. Have anyone seen any hands raised? Because we've got on the chat box, we've got a crisis known as the Logos. But would you say that it has to include a lot more than just reason? It has to include mythos. Mm. What are you pointing to in the terms of the invisible, only apprehended by the imagination? How would you understand Christ as poetic sacrament in this regard, the one who embodies divine reality for us? Answers on a postcard, please.
Right, thank you. Well, this is a very good question, and it takes us into the territory of the theologian and poet who has thought most about these matters, and particularly about Christ as Logos in relation not only to reason, which is the traditional relation, but in relation to imagination. And he was indeed going to write a book, Logosophia, but sadly he died before he did it. And that poet and theologian is Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Now, Coleridge thought that actually the Logos does include a great deal more than reason, because it is in the Logos, in John's prologue, that all things are poiein, all things are made. So he thinks that the Logos includes not only the Logos, which gives us logic and reason, but also the Logos, which gives us all words and poetry and the creative power. But Coleridge went a lot further than that. In the famous 13th chapter of his Biographia Literaria, when he comes to define what he calls the primary imagination, he says, the primary imagination is the, I'm quoting it directly now, is the living power and prime agent of all perception, and is a rep, this is the exact words of Coleridge, is a repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. So he thinks that whenever we perceive the world, let alone when we're creatively making something within it, the Logos within, because of course the Logos is the light which lightens everyone who comes into the world. So there's a Logos in here answering to the Logos behind all things. And all things are, as it were, the text of the poem he's made, shimmering into being as we read it. And he writes it simultaneously. So our perception is a repetition in our mind, in our finite mind, of the eternal act of creation as he does it. So Coleridge, in what he called his dynamic or communicative philosophy, thought that both our comprehension of the world and our apprehension of God are works of active imagination, prime, which doesn't mean we're making it up. It doesn't mean it's imaginary in the sense of not there. He's saying that the deepest things that are there require not only the physical senses and the reason, but also the imagination, which, as C.S. Lewis said, is the organ of meaning to get to it. So to go back to David's comment, yes, I think it includes mythos. Mythos is included in Logos in John's gospel, and so is ethos for that matter. And how would I understand Christ as the poetic sacrament? I mean, Christ is the supreme sacrament, from whom and in whom and out of whom all other sacramental possibility is realized, because he is Jacob's ladder. He is the point at which heaven and earth meet. And he is necessarily the poetic sacrament in the full sense of the word poetic, because the word was made flesh. The Logos is poeted into sarx, as it were. I realize I never got around to reading you the Edwin Muir. There's a way that we might bring that in. But anyway, do you want to? Well, maybe just while you think about the next question, I might say, going back to the original question about...
Much more concrete and personal. I passed over this one, which I apologise. But to Ruth Conde say, I enjoy reading your sonnets. Why are you so fond of the sonnet form?
Ah, that's a very good question. Well, partly, of course, simply because it's beautiful and it has a long history, and you can become part of a tradition by writing it. But I'll be frank with you. I mean, the thing, we often need our own opposite. We, particularly in the arts, we need something that pushes back against us and gives shape and form. And you've probably noticed by this time that I have a tendency to go on a bit. Once I get into flow, I just start flowing. I mean, my mother used to say to me, you've got the gift of the gab very galloping. But she also used to say, your tongue will get you hung, you know. And I realized that my danger as a poet would not be drying up, but would be just splurging on too much. And I was very struck by a passage about poetry in A Winter's Tale, where the poet says, our poesy is a current which flies each bound it chafes. So when the river is in a is in a channel with banks, it has to turn and it hits the bank, and the kind of beauty of the river comes with the spray that's driven up as the river is forced to turn. If you haven't got any banks, you just have a big splurgy puddle. So I realized that the sonnet, precisely because it's a strict form, precisely because you know when you're going to stop before you start and you write towards the end of a poem. And often when you write a sonnet and you get a good line, you think, I'll open with that line. It turns out that that's the closing line towards which you have to write, and so on. And that the form really works for me. In fact, when I first started writing the sonnets that go into Sounding the Seasons, in for the church in Cambridge that I served, St. Edward, King and Martyr, and we used to have a secular reading as well as the scriptural ones to have a sort of dialogue between the two. And I used to find the secular readings, and I started running out of them. So I thought, well, maybe I could write one, and I would be preparing a sermon. So I just would try and focus things into a sonnet. And when I did the 8 o'clock, I used to just read the sonnet, you know, as a short homily. And I can remember one of the patient 8 o'clockers saying to me afterwards with a sort of look of great relief on his face, and he said, Malcolm, why didn't you tell us earlier that you could do it in just 14 lines? You know? And so that's partly for the virtue of brevity.
Well, having alluded to secular readings, we have a question about from Janet. Does a poet have to be a Christian? Do I have to have a Christian label in order to comprehend?
No, absolutely not.
About God and humans in, for example, Rumi.
Yeah, no, I don't think a poet has to have a Christian label at all. I don't think they even have to have a religious label. I certainly think there's a great deal of truth in Rumi's poetry. But, and God has not left himself without witness. It's really interesting, isn't it, that when Paul is preaching at Mars Hill, and, you know, men of Athens, I see that in every way you're religious, for when I observed the statues of your objects of worship, I saw this statue to an unknown God. He whom you worship is unknown, him therefore I preach. That he starts with the idea that these people who are not Christians have nevertheless been able in some ways, he says in Romans, to feel after and find God. Which isn't to say that there is not a very specific important Christian revelation that needs to be shared, which Paul goes on to share. But it's interesting, he starts sharing it by quoting Aristarchus, a Greek poet, of whom we only have fragments, one of which is the one that Paul quotes us. For some of your own poets have said, in him we live and move and have, we are the offspring of God, in him and we live and move and have our being. So there's Paul quoting a pagan poet right in the middle of the Christian Gospels. I explore the question of poetry from our own more secular culture, because it's easy to read Rumi, you know, and it's religious poetry anyway. But I've got a chapter called Doubting Faith, Reticent Hope in my book, Faith, Hope and Poetry, which is about respectively Thomas Hardy, Philip Larkin and Geoffrey Hill. And there I rather controversially read those as in giving them a Christian interpretation.
Right. Now we've got an audio question. And now Helen Jesty had her hand up. Could we ask her to speak the question out loud?
Yep.
Unmute yourself.
Well, it's not a question, but thank you so much for this fantastic sharing that fires off in so many directions. But please, could you read your Love's Choice before the end and just make some comments on this amazing Edwin
okay.
Muir?
Thank you. I realized when I was answering the question about is there perhaps too much comprehension and not enough apprehension in the way we present the gospel in our own time. And actually, had I had time to go on to the Edwin Muir, that would have been about that. You'll have a chance to read the whole of the Edwin Muir yourselves. But Edwin Muir's poem, The Incarnate One, is not only about the mystery of the incarnation, but it's about the terrible way in which, in a sense, in the incarnation, God comes almost too close to us for comfort. And we push him back. We try and push him back into the abstract. And it starts with a lament, really, about how we unmake the incarnate one. And then it has the best description of bad church ever. As you know, Edwin Muir, I mean, he was a naturally gifted mystic, but he was brought up in a kind of strict double predestinarian Calvinism, which, you know, was, he found repellent. And so he left the church and became a communist. And then, of course, communism was no good for him in the end, because although it was about justice, it said man is an economic animal. And he knew that man wasn't an economic animal. And mercifully, he returned to the faith, but he returned to the faith more through apprehensions and comrades. Anyway, this is the best description of bad church ever. And it riffs on the John as well. The word made flesh is here made word again. A word made word in flourish and arrogant crook. See there, King Calvin with his iron pen. And God, three angry letters in a book. And here the mystery, and there the logical hook on which the mystery is impaled and bent into an ideological argument. There's better gospel in man's natural tongue. And that's partly why we need the poets as well as the theologians, because there is this danger of the mystery being impaled and bent into an ideological argument. But I do think that's one of the best things ever, to talk about a certain kind of wordy service, which is all ministry of the word and no other sacrament, as just, you know, the word made flesh is here made word again. Now, I'm not saying that the sacraments are the only way in which the word can be made flesh. The word is made flesh every time one Christian visits another and holds their hand and whispers a word of comfort, or they laugh together at a play, or stand in awe together at a sunset and feel each other's bodily amazement at being here. That's the word made flesh as well.
Right. Christian Jack has her hand up, possibly because I failed to notice her typed in question and asked you. So can I ask her to put it to you now verbally? Christian Jack?
Yes, it will do. Yes, I wrote it down as well. Some time ago, I began or tried to read Rowan Williams' Christ, the Heart of Creation, which is quite a difficult book, actually.
Yeah.
But I felt what we were talking about today helped to understand that. He was speaking about the word that we need to keep on speaking to keep it developing creatively.
That's a very interesting idea, and I think he's right. In a sense, the word speaks us. We are all logoi of the logos. He speaks us into being. But there's another sense in which he gives us the privilege of speaking him. That's the paradox of the divine name, you know, and Moses not, you know, wanting to know it and yet not being able to take it on his lips, and Christ using it in the I am sayings. So there's a sense in which we speak the one who speaks us, and we need to keep speaking that. I think, I can't remember, because you're right, it's a complex book, but that he's partly riffing on Eliot's Ash Wednesday, which itself is riffing on a piece by Lancelot Andrews, where Andrews, in a great Christmas sermon on which he called the Verbum Infans. So infans in Latin means without speech. So he's contemplating the mystery of Christ being born without knowing any language, you know, having to learn it from Mary. And he says, Andrews says, the word without a word, unable to speak a word. And then T.S. Eliot picks that up and says the word without a word, and says, the world still whirls around the center of the silent word. So the word is right in the heart of things, in a sense, speaking in all things into being and yet not speaking its own name, but that we've been given the privilege of speaking that name. I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Good. Mr. Markington, you've had your hand up for some time. Could you unmute yourself, please? No, you're still mute. Still mute. No, you're
going in.
Mute.
No, mate. Sorry. Okay. Ecstasies and agonies, your comment on sacraments. Going back to the 19th century, I'm minded to Manly Hopkins and Francis Thompson for the ecstasies and the agonies. Latterly, Thompson for the agonies, particularly in The Hound of Heaven. Where is the place of the poet in those two extremes?
Well, in a sense, Hopkins, you get both the ecstasies and the agonies. Because you've got, on the one hand, you've got the great statement that the world is charged with the grandeur of God, that it will shine out like shaking from shook foil, you know, and that we're just not seeing it, but it's there, ready to blaze out. There lives a deep down freshness and all things. And that's fundamental to the vision that I'm saying here as well, that at any moment, as it were, the window opens, the perilous casement, we see something, you know, a man that looks on glass on it may stay his eye, or if he pleaseth through it past. So there's that. But of course, Hopkins also speaks deeply to the agonies in the so-called terrible sonnets, you know, and no worse there is none, pitch past pitch of grief, and the mind has cliffs of fall. And the fact is, we inhabit both of those things. We necessarily, there's a relation between our capacity to vision, envision the heights, and our sensitivity to plummet down into the depths. And if you're going to have one, you kind of, at the moment in this fallen world, you can't have it without the other. And that's one of the reasons why the witness of the Gospels to Christ's humanity, as well as his divinity, is so important. Because you get, on the one hand, the Mount of Transfiguration, and on the other hand, the agony in the garden and the cry of dereliction from the cross. And what that means for me is that, if you like, the supreme poet, the Word who has now been embodied in flesh, also goes through the whole poetic spectrum from the ecstasy to the agony. I hope that helps. I see we're sort of coming probably a bit towards the end of our time, but there was a request that I would read Love's Choice, and maybe I should explain why I put it in there and how I'd intended. I wanted to talk about this.
I was going to suggest we use that as our sort of the beginning of our closing prayers.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
Appropriate. So that would be appropriate if we are now ending. I just want to make sure that there are
time for another,
further questions coming up, and we're not stifling off debate. There doesn't seem to be. And we're about on an hour and a half, which is just about what we allow ourselves. Perhaps that would be an appropriate way to end. Malcolm, on behalf of everybody, I really, really want to thank you. I mean, I've seldom known an hour's lecture go quite so fast. And I think perhaps, actually, having it on Zoom added something, because there was your face, full screen, right in front of me, a conversational distance, and it was much more a living conversation than it was a lecture, and I enjoyed that enormously, albeit that the conversation was for an hour slightly one-sided. It really has been most entertaining and mind-expanding. With all our profound thanks. Everybody's muted, so there's no point in asking them to applaud. But if you'd all like to wave, or you can put up a hand from the bottom of on reactions. You all put up a hand for Malcolm.
See
on
your screen. His golden thumbs.
That's our way of giving him thanks.
That's very kind. Just flashing through the screen. That's very kind. See somebody's niche.
And then I think. And then, Linda, you were going to close the closing prayer, is that right?
Linda, you're muted. No,
I think if Malcolm can read the prayer, do you want me to share the screen, Malcolm?
If Malcolm reads the poem, and then should we all actually unmute and say the grace together?
At the end of the poem, yeah. So I'd say that the reason why I included this poem in the handout was that I wanted to say that what is true about imagination body, about Christ being the bodying forth of all of heaven into the earth, so that it's available and accessible to us, yeah, comprehensible, but yeah, nevertheless ushering us through to new apprehension. I really wanted to say that that's not just, in my view, a one-off event that happened at Christmas when the Word was made flesh, that the Word continues to be made flesh and dwelt among us in so many ways, and that for me, one of the most essential and beautiful of those ways is in the sacrament of Holy Communion, and that's why I wanted to finish with this poem. So I'll read the poem to you. Love's Choice. This bread is light, dissolving, almost air, a little visitation on my tongue, a wafer-thin sensation, hardly there. This taste of wife is brief in flavour, flung a moment to the palate's roof and fled, even its aftertaste a memory. Yet, this is how he comes. Through wine and bread, love chooses to be emptied into me. He does not come in unimagined light, too bright to be denied, too absolute for consciousness, too strong for sight, leaving the seer blind, the poet mute. Chooses instead to seep into each sense, to dye himself into experience. So should we say the grace?
So